Shrink Wrap Radio number 461, Strategies for Getting Therapy Clients Unstuck, with Courtney Armstrong.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is licensed professional counselor and author, Courtney Armstrong. She specializes in grief and trauma recovery. Today, we'll be discussing her latest book, The Therapeutic Aha, 10 Strategies for Getting Your Clients Unstuck. For more information about Courtney Armstrong, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Courtney Armstrong, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me today.
Well, I love your book. We're going to be talking about your book. And part of the reason I like it so much is that you reference so many of the people that I've interviewed here on Shrink Wrap Radio.
I certainly have.
Yeah, it confirms to me that I'm tracking the right people.
Well, yes. And some of those people I found out about through your show, too. So,
well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
You are doing a marvelous service for our community and have been for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. And it's nice to know that there's some resonance between us. I mean, yes. I'm feeding you stuff, you're feeding me stuff, and that's
right,
great.
Right. That's how it should work.
Yeah. And what a wonderful integration you have done. You know, some of the people that came to mind are Bruce Ecker, Bessel van der Kolk, Joe Ledoux, Bill O'Hanlon, Jack Panksepp, Bonnie Badnock, Dan Siegel, Stephen Porges, among others. And yes. So not only are those people that I've interviewed, but people that you've drawn heavily upon,
yes.
among others, and,
yes.
and you've done this wonderful synthesis, so my hat's off to you.
Oh, well, thank you. That means so much to me. Yeah, you know, I mean, one of my motivations for writing this book is, I think, you know, sometimes psychotherapy's gotten so disjointed in that, oh, should I do this model, should I do that model, and I really began to see the common denominators, and I really wanted to pull that out. Bruce Ecker and I share a lot of the same ideas, and he and I have talked about we want to help unify the profession a little more, although I don't think that will ever completely happen.
Yeah.
It may help us have a more common base to work from, a common language at least, when we're talking.
I think so. I really see it coming together. That's something I've talked about on the show. And there's just, it seems like there's a lot of commonality these days, and it's kind of coming together. There'll always be some people off on the side that it's harder to integrate into, but
yeah.
You talk about, and we'll get to this as I'm going to kind of lead you through your book, and we'll probably get to some place where we talk about some of those commonalities. But let's start, before we get into your book, what can you tell us about your professional background? How did you get here?
Well, I've been a therapist for 20 years. So I actually went to graduate school in New Orleans. I got a graduate assistantship. I was awarded a graduate assistantship at University of New Orleans. And at that time, I really wanted to work with children. And so part of that grant was me getting an opportunity to work in this inner city program with kids. And it's, you know, I was young and idealistic. And so.
Yeah, right. And then you hit the inner city school, right?
Right. And I did have some family from Baton Rouge. I mean, I was familiar with the New Orleans area. I wasn't completely naive, but you know, that first day walking into that program, I thought, what am I thinking? These kids are going to eat me alive. And and actually, you know, they were pretty guarded, and they weren't mean to me at all. Like, I was worried they were going to heckle me and stuff, but actually they just didn't speak. And so, you know, I was given actually a manual to take in. We were supposed to do this conflict resolution training, and it was based on cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay. With these worksheets and whatnot. And I had this sense before I walked in that was not going to work with these kids. But when I walked in and got that reaction, I thought, yeah, this isn't going to work. I've got to figure out how to connect with them and try to understand their world as best I can, and figure out how to make this relevant to their culture and their daily experiences, which, you know, not to be crass, but basically their daily struggle was, am I going to survive today? You know, I mean, people are getting shot to death every day in their neighborhood. So for me to give this kind of trite type of intervention wasn't going to work with them. We had to really dig in there. And the kids in the inner city, especially in New Orleans, are so creative. That culture in New Orleans really supports creativity. So that's the way I had to connect with them.
Yeah, you tell a wonderful story about that, I think, in the introduction to the book. And by the way, I probably should mention the title. The title of the book is The Therapeutic Aha, 10 Strategies for Getting Your Clients Unstuck. And it's such a great title. And the cover, the title could give a little bit of the feeling of, oh, this is going to be a superficial book. But it's not. So I have to say that right at the outset.
Well,
so tell the, if you can repeat that story of what you came up with to get these kids excited and engaged, because that's really what your whole approach to therapy is now.
It is. That's right. So, you know, I'm from the South, so I grew up in Atlanta. And I come from a long line of animated storytellers.
Good for you.
And know how to, I know how to act out and that kind of thing. So, and be silly. So what I said to them, in that first group, one girl that I attempted to interact with, she just literally drew a picture of a brick wall on a piece of paper and handed it back to me. And I knew what that meant. And I said, listen, I know that you think this is ridiculous. They're sending some white chick in here to try to tell you how to navigate your world. And I know that I don't understand your world. So the first place we need to start is help me get it. Help me get what you guys are dealing with every day. I really do want to understand it. And of course they looked at me like maybe, but still wasn't getting there. And I said, I tell you what, if for everyone who participates today in the class, I will do an awkward white girl dance for you.
An awkward white girl dance. That reminds me of on Jerry Seinfeld, right? And Elaine does an awkward white girl dance. Were you thinking of that?
Yes, that's what I was thinking about, because this was the 90s, you know, and Seinfeld was in its heyday. And and I was fair. Like, they could say anything, like, hi, my name is, you know, I'm trying to think of, hi, my name is Centel, you know, was one of the biggest guys in there. And then I'd do a little dance and they just thought that was hilarious. So, you know, that's how we kind of got the chemistry started. And then, you know, it wasn't overnight, but every time I came in, I said, well, let's just start with you guys. Tell me what kind of music you're into. You know what? Tell me some music that you like. I'll see if I can find it. We can listen to music and you can break it down for me. And, but a lot of it was me following what I talk about in the book. You've got to follow the client's energy. You know, what gets them energized? What gets their attention? That to pick them in the direction you want them to be going. And so that's what I was looking for. You know, I didn't consciously know that at the time. I just knew I gotta build a connection and understand where we can relate to one another, and then somehow use that to still get these concepts across to them that the grant, you know, program wants us to teach in terms of conflict resolution. You know, how to work out your differences without killing each other is basically what they wanted us to help them with. And it evolved granted, I'm working in a group setting, so it lent itself to this a little bit better. But eventually what we came up with was, we came up with a mock shoe design business. And when I was an undergrad, I worked at a shoe store, and one of the kids in the group would draw these amazing athletic shoes. And I said, you know, you could work for Nike, you know, or something like that. I mean, you really got some talent there. And he said, wow, really? That has never occurred to me. And what they helped me understand, David, was that in their world, all that they believed, they would say, Miss Courtney, there's only three options for us after if we finish school. And it doesn't even seem worthwhile to finish school, because the only options we have are, we could, if we get really lucky, we might get picked for the NBA, which is like they all knew was a complete long shot.
Really?
Or we can work at McDonald's, or we can deal drugs. And most of
or
us
we
know
can
we're
what?
Deal drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's our only options. The world doesn't work for us. We're not going to get the kind of jobs white people get. And that's, so what I had to do is help them believe they had a future. That was step one. And then through us kind of creating this little mock business together, they had to learn how to get along with each other. And, but we had to create something that was relevant to their world. And that's just where that whole concept got started for me. But, as I got into working in hospitals and with the medical model, it unfortunately kind of got beat out of me to be that creative and, innovative.
Yes.
And I don't think it literally needed to go that way. I just got the impression that, wait a minute, I can't do this stuff within the serious environment. It worked with the kids.
You can't be your storytelling, playful, spontaneous
right.
self.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
now let's get into that some, into how somewhere in there you became a counselor, right? You started out in education and then you became a counselor. And,
right.
And the power of emotion is a thread that runs throughout the book.
Right.
How did you come to realize the importance of emotions in psychotherapy?
Well, my graduate school program trained me in cognitive behavioral therapy, but my internship placement also was more of a psychodynamic oriented center. So I had a blend of both things, but at that time, which was it was 1995 when I finished graduate school and started working in the medical field, this cognitive behavioral therapy was what was expected of us, and
yes.
managed care wanted you to frame everything that way.
Yes.
And yet I realized that it wasn't quite getting people the results. Like I felt like I felt like I was so effective in my internship, you know, when I didn't know what I was doing. And now that I'm, you know, trying to do what, you know, the evidence-based.
Yeah. The quote, right way.
Yeah. We weren't getting we would get somewhere, but it would take a longer amount of time. And sometimes I felt, silly, you know, trying to help. What most clients know when they come to therapy is that they know what they're doing, feeling, or thinking is irrational. So for me to try to help them look at how irrational it is was wasting their time. It's like, I already know that. I want you to tell me how to fix it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I finally, through my hypnosis training, I actually worked in a center for mind body medicine. I kind of made my way through a few different settings and eventually landed in at the Center for Integrative Medicine in my hometown, which is Chattanooga, Tennessee now. And the physician there trained with Andrew Weil and stuff, and he was really supportive of me pursuing hypnosis training, biofeedback and whatnot. And then, but I realized through hypnosis, oh, you're just creating an experience. That's all this is. You just have to create an experience in the session that gets the client to do what you want them to do, or to feel how they want themselves to feel, rather. And then I learned about an eccentric hypnotherapist. I trained with Bill O'Hanlon, actually, in Ericksonian hypnotherapy, and got to know Bill and that approach there.
Yeah,
and then
I've never met him, but I've interviewed him a couple of times, and he's absolutely delightful.
He is, and he just breaks things down in such a simple way, you know.
Yeah.
But also profound in some ways. And then I found out about an eccentric hypnotherapist in Southern Florida named John Connolly, who had a model of using hypnosis to treat trauma called rapid resolution therapy. That's what he calls it. And that's really when I got confident, David, about bringing myself back into the session and how I use the therapeutic relationship in the session. Because what I saw John do, I mean, he's really dynamic and eccentric, arrogant, but he really adapts his personality to what the client needs.
I had never heard of him, so I want to thank you for introducing him to me. I've been interested in hypnosis. That was a big part of my early orientation. Yeah, the whole Ericksonian approach and so on. But strangely, I guess I sort of haven't been in that world for a while, and I had not heard of John Connolly. But you inspired me, actually, just before the session here that we're having right now. I went on YouTube and watched him work and a lot of testimonials to his work. So, you know, I probably will want to approach him to be a guest here at some point. So I interrupted you mid-sentence. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Well, you would really enjoy him. You know, he knows what I saw John do, what he calls rapid resolution therapy. And by the way, he never wanted to call it anything. He was getting such profound results with clients trying to train other therapists how to do it, that, you know, there was some pressure. You need to name this. You need to manualize it. And so he's kind of been forced to figure out how to teach it by manualizing it and structuring it. But honestly, he tells you most of it just comes to me intuitively, and I don't even know why I came up with that idea at that particular time.
Interesting.
And really what he wants us to get more than anything, and what I wanted people to get through this book, is when you are really connecting with the client at that deeper, like what Alan Shore calls right brain to right brain, you begin to intuit more about what this client might respond to. It begins to come to you more. I think, oh, she seems like she would be responsive to imagery, or she would be responsive to movement, or he would really like a story. And basically, as I started, John Connolly asked me to go teach his method to, he said, I don't know how to teach it. You seem to know how to help people get it in our small groups and stuff. When we would break into groups, he would ask me to help coach some of the people in our class. And so he asked me to go out and teach it, like just on a one day level, to introduce people to it. And I realized I needed to get grounded in some theory and figure out, well, what is making this work so effectively for people? And that's when I started really looking deeper into the neuroscience and getting all of this validation that what we intuitively know as therapists works, that it's not all hokey, some of this stuff that we've, you know, do with people experientially, that what the neuroscience is actually suggesting, in my opinion, is that where patterns get stuck is in that subcortical part of the brain, what we would refer to as the emotional brain. And that's also what the subconscious basically is. That's where that part of the brain learns through experience, association, and repetition. And it isn't well connected to our verbal center, so it doesn't learn through words. And so when we're working in therapy, we've got to go beyond the intellectual discussion about what's happening, and we've got to figure out, how do we create an experience that teaches your emotional brain what we want it to learn? Mm-hmm. And when I started doing that with clients, and I'm more transparent, I just tell clients that. I said, so on one level, you've got it. You understand, but we've got to figure out how to get it on that other level so that you really feel what it is you want to believe. And they're like, yes, yes, yes. And so I'll try a few things, and they kind of catch on to what I'm doing, whether I use a story, and we'll get into some examples as we go along. And then they'll help you out. They'll go, oh, you know what? That reminds me of this story, and that would fit the situation perfectly. But they started getting all of these aha moments and having fun. I mean, people were cracking up because people that I work with, I own a group practice, but people were walking out of my sessions laughing and just light on their feet. And they were like, what are you doing in there?
That's got to be so gratifying for you. I mean, it sounds like these ideas mesh perfectly with your personality and with your background so that it just flows through you.
It does. And I think it can flow through all of us. You know, my style is going to be more animated, playful, extroverted. But if you're more of a reserved type of therapist, you have ways that you create experiences in your sessions, maybe just through your relationship with them. But that's really what I wanted to highlight. It's really about, it goes back to creating those corrective emotional experiences, you know, like we talked about in psychoanalysis years ago.
Yeah. Now, you talked about stories. I love the story that you tell in the introduction that you titled Sandra's Sunrise.
Yes.
Can you take us through that a bit here?
Yes. Yes. So this was an example of a woman who was a surgeon. And I've changed some of the details to protect her confidentiality, but she came, and she had been to many therapists, and she had had a pretty emotionally abusive childhood. It wasn't physically abusive. And of course, she had been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and treatment resistant depression. And she had been to, maybe 4 or 5 psychiatrists in her lifetime and, you know, 10 or more therapists. But here she was in a situation again where her emotional outbursts were getting her into trouble. So her job was on the line. Mm-hmm. And she called me at the recommendation of her psychiatrist here in Tennessee, who knew that I did. She said, you know, I know that you've had some success working with people who aren't responding to traditional techniques. So would you like to give this one a try? And I said, sure. And so What happened with Sandra is she came in telling me that I'm 40 years old. I know this goes back to how I was raised, and, you know, and I understand it all intellectually, and yet it still hasn't changed in all these years. And she felt defective, you know, why can't I get it?
Yeah.
And I explained to her, and luckily, you know, her being a physician, and she was a very intelligent person, I said, well, this is how your brain works. You know, you learn it on this other level that doesn't even speak in words. No wonder you can't, you know, we're never going to get it by just analyzing it. And I said, so let's try some other ways of getting the same message through. And so the first thing that I asked her is, tell me, I always start with, what results do you want this session or us working together to get for you? Well, I want to feel okay about me. Like I just feel defective and like I'm never going to be okay. And I want to be able to be calm at work and respond to people without biting their heads off. So I said, well, let's get an image that would represent that for you. And so the emotional brain, if you use words like we learn in hypnosis, it only understands about 5 words or less at a time. So you have to say, so I said, so when you think about your mind working this way, at ease, secure, being able to pause before you respond to something, what comes to mind? Something in nature or an animal in the wild that would represent you at ease, secure, peaceful, thoughtful, you know, being able to respond, you know, in a thoughtful way. She knew what I meant by that. And, she says, well, you know, a sunrise. So then the other thing that we needed to do was change her identity. And this, David, actually comes from psychosynthesis. Yes, John Connolly told me he got it from psychosynthesis. And I said, so she was, you know, told me that she hated herself. And I said, so we already had the sunrise imagery working. And I said, so tell me about a time when you've seen something in nature that was just beyond beautiful, a time that maybe you saw that. And she said, well, when I see the sunrise over this lake near my home, I go running every morning and it's just beautiful. And sometimes, and she really was vividly describing the colors of the sky in such a beautiful way, because she actually, like many surgeons, she has some artistic talent. Uh-huh. They're good with working with their hands, you know. And she said, these beautiful muted violets and peachy. I mean, she was really getting into it. So I wasn't putting her in a trance, but she was getting into that altered state of consciousness. Yes. So that's what you want to see, that she's actually experiencing what I want her to feel and believe. And I said, so let's think of it this way. I said, when you looked at that sunrise, it seems to me you were getting in touch with feelings of peace, joy, awe. Yes, yes, all of that. And I said, well, some people might think of it as that sunrise dropping that experience inside of you. But I think that it was actually bringing to your awareness where you already feel at ease, peaceful, joyful. You already have access to that at your center. But sometimes it's closer to your awareness, like when you're running and looking at that sky by the lake. And at other times, it's moved further away from your awareness, like when somebody was yelling at you, when some nurse was yelling at you in the operating room. But it's always there, and that's who you are. So you have a body, you're not your body. You have thoughts, you're not your thoughts. You have feelings, you're not your feelings. Who are you? Let's think of you as that light of peace, wisdom, excitement that you get in touch with when you're running by the lake. That's you. And she began to cry. And she said, that is the sweetest thing I've ever heard. And she said, I have never thought of myself in that way. I've only thought of myself as a negative, depressed person. And so what you have to do is you have to pull an experience they've actually had in their life, if possible, that you can associate, because it's hard for them to argue with an experience they've had. And I didn't say this is who you are. I just said, let's think of it this way so that I could avoid disagreement. let's think of it this way for a moment.
Yeah. It's kind of like, even though you didn't do an elaborate hypnotic induction, nevertheless, there are sort of indirect hypnotic sorts of suggestions there. And one of the things that I'm struck by in your story is you immediately moved her off the problem and thinking about the problem, and got her into this place of inner peace.
Yes, that's right. That's really key in how I'm working with people now. And they give me that feedback that they enjoy that experience. It's tricky to know how to move the client in that direction. And we'll talk about that in a moment, but it really, I'm just trying to help her access a resource that we can use to work through the problem. But I've got to get a resource before we can do it, I believe. And that's part of the trick. And that in those initial sessions, I'm trying to listen and understand the problem as I'm also exploring for resources and bringing them to her awareness.
Yes.
And what the comment that just touched me so much when we finished our work together is, she said, you know, people always told me I needed how to learn to love myself. You actually showed me how to do that. Wow. And that just,
Yeah, that's a real tribute.
Yeah.
In one place, I think you kind of describe your approach as a cognitive experiential approach to change. And so what all does that imply, that phrase, cognitive experiential?
Well, I believe that we are still looking for maladaptive beliefs, so to speak. You know, the beliefs that the distorted beliefs and perceptions that are keeping keeping somebody stuck in a pattern. But instead of trying to use logical arguments, like we sometimes do in cognitive therapy, it's more like we create an experience to change the meaning they're attaching to an event or to change a belief that they've had about themselves. And Seymour Epstein is the psychologist who developed cognitive experiential theory of self. Okay. So he is also just super interesting and released his seminal book last year. He's a professor emeritus at University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he's retired, and I think he's maybe 90 years old now. And he's been developing this theory for, you know, 40 years. But his theory is basically we have two ways our brain processes information. One is through a rational system and one's through an experiential system. And what I thought was so interesting, David, is that there were all these books out that the lay public was buying on this very concept, like the most popular one, Thinking Fast and Slow. So you've got your system one, as Kahneman calls it, that processes information experientially and intuitively. And then you have another way the brain's processing information rationally. And sometimes those two systems aren't communicating well together. and I realized that, Epstein just developed the theory. I mean, he doesn't get into doing therapy, but he talked about how he knows using imagery and fantasy works better for teaching and revising somebody's beliefs and his experience than just straight on talking about it. And he talks about how his wife used imagery to heal herself from cancer. So it was just such a huge thing in his life to see that at work. But yeah, and the reason I think it's important to think of it as cognitive experiential is because we feel really pressured as therapists to have evidence-based interventions that we're using in our sessions. So, and the experiential techniques we're using are not experiential in terms of being cathartic or, you know, expressive, but they're intentional experiences. We're creating intentional experiences to change a belief that the client has.
That's a very good distinction that you've just made. Because in the early days of experiential psychotherapy, I think there was a lot of emphasis on catharsis.
And, yes.
So I think that's a nice, very nice distinction.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we were intending with the cathartic processes and the express. I think we were intending, well, maybe if we can just get this out, you know, and you can express it, you'll be able to integrate it and move forward. I mean, I think that was what we thought would happen,
sure.
But it doesn't a lot of time. I mean, I specialize in working with trauma, and, you know, until I change the meaning that client is attached to the trauma, every time they talk about it, they're going to feel the same crappy way.
Yeah.
So part of what I got to do is not just have them cathart about it, but let's figure out a new experience, a new way of feeling, perceiving this thing that would change how you feel about it.
Yeah. One of the other things that we learned about catharsis is that, for example, expressing anger by pounding on pillows or whatever is that that's a rehearsal of the negative emotions, a rehearsal of the negative experience, you know, to go into a lot of crying and to encourage that and so on. It's kind of rehearsing the negative story. Mm-hmm. Whereas what you're doing is you're using these emotional hooks to move it in a positive direction.
That's right. That's right. And Joe Ledoux, and one of, you know, he has a band called the Amygdaloids.
Yes, I know.
And he, in one of the songs called Fear, he says, remembering is not forgetting. It's mental rehearsal, or it's vivid rehearsal of pain. And I think that's so true in our well-intentioned attempts to help somebody work through an experience. But, yeah, we don't want them to confuse processing it with re-experiencing it and rehearsing it, as you say.
Yeah. In one of your chapters, you describe seven primary emotional systems. It's probably been some time since you've read your book. I'm wondering if you can remember them and quickly take us through them.
Well, this was inspired by Jack Panksepp's work, and he has identified seven primary emotional systems, and he distinguishes them as primary systems in that they turn on without you cognitively or, you know, at least rationally thinking about them. So this is another area where cognitive, and I'm not knocking cognitive therapy. There's definitely a place for it. But when we're working with people, usually they're coming to us because these emotions are turning on automatically before they even have a chance to think about it. So if you say, well, you need to control your thoughts, or like, hey, this thing just turned on, I wasn't even thinking about anything. And that's what Panksepp says, that these are primary systems because they get activated through this sensory system. So when your emotional brain, or what some people might think of as the limbic system, the amygdala and thalamus and basal ganglia, detect something familiar in the environment that was associated with a prior threat, then it's going to immediately activate that fight or flight response before you even know what spooked you. It's just instant. And you know, it's like we consciously catch up with, oh, wait, I'm feeling scared. What is it?
Yeah.
So this is, I think, important for us to consider as therapists. And I love when I explain this to my clients, it's a way that can help you figure out an antidote to the client's problem. And my clients enjoy it too. So the seven systems are, the first system is seeking, S-E-E-K-I-N-G. So Panksepp really emphasizes this because we don't talk about it a lot, but it's the system that often is integrated with all the other systems. It's the get up and go get it system. So what I boil it down to is all emotion is a request for an action. It's just asking you to do something. It's just your brain trying to get you to do something. So what is seeking asking you to do is saying, hey, get up and go get it. It's our motivation and drive system. When the seeking system's gone awry, meaning it's overacting, activated, that would be like what you see in obsessive compulsive disorder or substance abuse.
Right.
And when it's not very activated, that's what you see in depression. And so the way I'll explain it to my clients is that you know, sometimes what depression is just your body asking you to withdraw energy from something that isn't working. It's actually saying, hey, don't move towards that. Quit, withdraw your energy. It's a waste of the resources here. But it'll feel global, like you want to withdraw from everything. But does that make sense to you? What in your life may not be working that you've been putting a lot of effort into and feel like it's not getting you anywhere? And they almost always know, they're like, oh my God, I said, so true. But it helps them feel less crazy, you know, when I say it's just your mind trying to get you to do something adaptive here. And then what we want to do is redirect your energy towards something that would excite your seeking system, that would interest it. So going back to Sandra, who we were talking about earlier, she came in saying, oh, help me learn how to manage my stress at work. And, but when we started talking about some practical things she could do, just like using mindfulness and the imagery we were doing, I could tell by the look on her face that it was okay, but it wasn't really getting her excited. And so I mentioned that. I said, I can tell that you think these techniques might be somewhat useful, but I can tell you're not going to do them. They're not getting excited. She goes, well, I mean, it's not that. And I said, well, what's more compelling to you than your job? And she goes, my kids. And it was immediate. And so when we tied her therapy goals, not to work, but to, I'm seeing us, you using these tools because it's going to allow you to come home and have enough energy to be with your children and enjoy them and not be worn out from all this, you know, letting everything get to you at work. How would that be? And she's like, that's it. That motivates me.
Great.
And so that's what we got to do as therapists. So seeking is really important because we've got to follow their energy, see what turns that on, and that's going to pivot them out of the distress a lot of times when you can identify what that is.
Okay, what's the second emotional system?
The second system is fear. And fear, what I tell my clients is fear is just saying, hey, get away from that thing. It seems dangerous. it's just to make it not so heavy, you know. And so the other thing that's useful is that Pinksepp distinguishes panic disorder from fear. And we'll get into that a little bit later, but panic is actually getting generated from a different emotional system, where fear is literally you perceive something in the environment as threatening and you want to move away from it. And the other thing that I like to suggest to my clients is that what we know from neuroscience is that the amygdala mediates fear in a different way than it does anger. So even though we call it fight or flight, they actually traverse different networks. And so when it goes down when the amygdala sends it down the fear network, it's actually going to cause your heart to beat faster, your breathing to get more shallow, but it's going to move energy to your lower body. So you're going to, you'll feel like empty in bowel and bladder, and your legs may tremble because your body's actually sending glucose, oxygen, and adrenaline to your legs to make them stronger so you can run faster. So anxiety, fear is strengthening your body. Mm-hmm. And that is often really empowering for them. And or if they're coming to me with irritable bowel syndrome and they don't know what's going on with that, for example, some somatic complaint having to do with the lower body, I'll say, what in your life are you trying to get away from right now? Does that make some sense, that there's something that feels threatening that you got to move away from? And that will almost always get us to the root of the problem.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then anger is the third system. So anger is your emotional brain asking for something in the world to stop. It's trying to get you to make something in the world stop. Or it's saying, hey, something's thwarting my ability to move towards something. Get it out of my way. Mm-hmm. So when it's anger, still have the cardiovascular arousal, heartbeats faster, breathing gets shallow, but you'll notice energy goes up, jaw clenches, face flushes, upper body tightens. That's because emotional brain is trying to get you to move forward and bite something, because we share the emotional brain with the animals, right? It's our mammalian brain. So in the wild, if you want something to stop or get out of your way, you bite them.
Yeah, right.
Or you move them with your upper body out of the way. So when clients are coming to me complaining of things like TMJ or teeth grinding or all this upper body tension, I'll say, you know, I won't make assumptions, but I'll say, what do you want to stop in the world? What is something going on in your life that you want to stop or get out of your way? And they almost instantly have an answer for that. And I'll say that your body's just trying to get you to do that, but you recognize this way of doing it hasn't been to your advantage. Like biting your boss is probably not going to be to your advantage. So we've got to just get your emotional brain to go at it a different way, to teach it a new response that would work in your best interest. The fourth system is care. So this is important because we often think of the emotional brain, like Freud thought of the id, as being very self-centered and hedonistic, but the emotional brain is actually wired for care. We are wired to want to connect with each other, to nurture each other, and support each other. And the reason why I like to highlight this is, one, to help therapists know that your caring relationship with a client is so healing and important. If you don't do anything else, that really does make a difference. And it's also to help us consider antidotes. So when someone is feeling afraid, or like what we're going to talk about next, panicked, with the antidote is they've got to move into connection and care with someone. Mm-hmm. So we've actually, you know, the way that people used to respond at major disasters were with the critical incident stress debriefing protocol, and it's actually been replaced by psychological first aid. And part of it was because what people said helped them the most right after a trauma or a disaster was getting to a place of safety and feeling like someone cared, like there was someone there to say, how are you doing? Can we get you you anything? And can we get you into connection with one of your loved ones, one of your family members? And that, they said, was the single most thing that seemed to separate who got PTSD from who didn't.
Oh, fascinating.
Actually. Yeah. So as we're working with trauma, I just like to emphasize, you know, that can go a long way when you're helping somebody work through a traumatic memory, is just you showing up and responding to them in a different way, in a caring way from maybe the people in their life earlier who didn't know what to do. And that also becomes important. Actually, Alexander and French talk about that in the 1940s, that they were psychoanalysts who talked about this corrective emotional experience. And they said that was one of the primary things, that the therapist was showing up and responding in a different way from the way people had responded to the patient earlier. That was the healing element.
Yeah, good.
And then the fifth system is the panic, grief, distress system. And so it's interesting what Pinkset found is panic is more of a separation anxiety, separation distress than it is. It's fear, but it's tied to feeling separated from your pack or your loved one. So he puts that in with grief because when we feel grief, what we're feeling is separation. And the antidote to grief is to feel back in connection with your loved one or something that you care about. So I also wrote a book on transforming traumatic grief. And actually what we found in the literature is that while we used to encourage people to accept that their loved one was gone, that's not the most helpful way to think of it. It's actually more healing to help the person develop some kind of continuing bond with the deceased, some way that they could carry on their legacy or still feel connected to the essence of that person. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean like a ghost or a spirit necessarily, no. But there's some people like to take that literally. But just feeling like you internalized what you loved about that person into your essence and carry that forward in your life. So then it doesn't feel like they're really missing from your life, because what we feel when we grieve is the same thing a baby bird does when it falls out of the nest and gets separated from its mother. It cries out and it's trying to call the loved one home. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was interviewing people who had experienced traumatic grief, so many of them said, when I found out about the death, the first thing I wanted to do was to cry out their name or to cry out no. And it's because we are wired to want to call the loved one back, mm-hmm. and get back the connection. And when somebody's experiencing panic disorder, David, I'll often explore, is there some kind of perceived loss or perceived separation going on somewhere in their life? And that will actually lead us more directly to the root of the panic disorder than anything else. So, Yeah. So I think it's really useful for us as therapists to understand these systems.
Yeah. So many good clues that you're giving us here.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the last one is my favorite one, and that's play. So we're actually wired for play. And they used to think that play was just, the animals were wired for play in order to learn survival skills, because predators play by hunting. Like, think of your cat. You know, your cat's going to hunt and stalk, and that's how they play, batting around a ball. And then animals of prey, like deer, play by running and hiding. So they thought, well, you know, you're just rehearsing survival skills. But actually, Pinkset and his colleagues have determined that we play just for connecting with each other. He calls it social joy. So there it goes back to that care system again, that we actually are wired to want to enjoy each other and not devour each other.
Yeah. Now, I think we might be missing one. I've got six here. I've been taking notes.
I forgot. I can't believe I forgot. This was a Freudian slip. Lust.
Oh, yes. How could we forget that?
Yes. So basically, what Pinkset says about lust is, you know, it's about procreating, you know, on a basic level. But again, there seems are for men. Men's visual systems are more intricately connected to their lust systems, emotional systems.
You don't need
to tell
me that.
Right. And for women, this would not be a surprise. Their care and bonding networks mm-hmm. are more intricately linked up with their lust systems. So mm-hmm. it doesn't mean women aren't turned on visually, and it doesn't mean men don't like being feeling cared about, but it may help us understand why we respond and approach, you know, sex in different ways, and not to take it personally and you know, get offended. But, yeah, women are more, you know, of course, receptors, our oxytocin receptors are more intricately connected into our lust networks. Our care networks seem to be more. And again, it's not across the board. Of course, everybody can be wired a little bit differently, but it may help us understand each other a little bit better.
Have you had people come to you where the lust network was somehow the thing of focus?
Yes.
I mean, therapeutically.
Yeah. Yeah. For some people, I think what is really sad in relationships is that, you know, women, sometimes men are trying to connect emotionally through the lust system. That's how they feel cared about, you know, right. That they aren't going to feel cared about by having a deep discussion or watching a chick flick. They feel that care and bonding gets turned on through physical touch. And so I think a lot of times women are misunderstanding that, and they aren't realizing that actually the man is bidding for connection. Mm-hmm. And it can happen in the opposite. I mean, there's some women who have a stronger sex drive than their partner, and it can happen that way too. And then sometimes I think, for women, actually who've gotten kind of, that low sex drive that's developed over time because they felt like there's so many demands on them. Oh gosh, here's another person wanting my care. Oh my gosh, another person, yeah. You know, and that's, they're pushing their husband or their mate away because it's like, I'm sorry, I can't bond. I can't, you know, nurture another person anymore today. Those women to do is be more playful have them find ways to be more playful in their interaction with their mates so that the lust system can get kind of more back into that social joy and social connection that way. So for instance, I'll tell women, and I actually learned this from Dr. Connolly. I'll encourage women, like, sometimes you have to be a tease, you know, be playful, flirty, but you know, you can be in control of when it happens, you know, but often what will happen is it'll happen because they're being more playful with it and not feeling like it's such a demand on their energy.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of a story about Milton Erickson, the great hypnotherapist. And a couple came to see him where the libido was low, and he instructed the wife, I guess the wife was the one who had come to see him and the husband wasn't being that responsive. And so... Yeah. He instructed the wife to get a squirt gun and to squirt him with water and then run away. And so he chased her and they ended up in the bedroom.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, you know, play can really go, and it can go a long way in our connection with our clients. So when I talk about the title of my book being How to Get Clients Unstuck, I'm not necessarily talking about resistance in its purest form, but just when you're kind of feeling stuck or the therapy is getting stalled, and I've found, or if you do see some resistance, like I did with the kids in New Orleans, play can be a great way to bond and connect.
Well, how do you get play into a therapy session? Let's say does a case come to mind maybe where that was an important leverage for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So one of the cases, and I talk about this one in the book, was a client that I call Michael. And Michael scared me. When he came to me, he had severe panic with agoraphobia. He would go to work, but that's it. And he'd also had become severely alcoholic, and he was depressed and suicidal. And yet when he came to me in therapy, he liked to spar with me, you know. So even our first session, he's like, I don't know if you can help me. This is my last chance. This is my last ditch effort, but somebody told me that you could probably help me, but you know, don't feel bad if you can't, you know, it was one of those things.
Yeah.
And then anything I said, he would make a joke about it or be really sarcastic. And so, one day, but I liked him. I mean, I liked his energy though. I mean, I liked that he had some of that anger and edginess, because I thought, you know, we can use that to move him in a direction. Mm-hmm. At least there's some energy here we can work with. He's not completely bedridden. And, so one day he came into the session, and we'd actually been practicing on how to, work with his panic. And, you know, and I asked him if there was something he felt separated from, and, or where a loss had occurred. And he didn't have a whole lot of insight, because he was just barely 30. But you know, he said he did feel a separation from his father. And had felt that for a long time, but that's the only thing he could identify. And so, but we were just working on some basic things to make him less fearful of his panic sensations using humor. And he was really good with that, you know, where we would make the sensations funny. Like I would get him to, okay, turn on just a little bit of that panic right now. And then we played a little game where I'd ask him questions about stuff he didn't care about. And his job was to say, whatever, knock yourself out. I don't
care. You had him say that. You told him to say that.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And what we were doing is evoking indifference. Mm-hmm. And what would happen, and I didn't invent this, I actually learned this from Dr. Connolly, is he would start to associate that feeling of indifference with his panic sensations. So remember, the emotional brain learns through association, classical conditioning. So I'm starting to pair it with something new. Uh-huh. And we would, and it was fun because it was indirect and playful, and he like got to curse me out and things like that. And then he was getting better. And so one day he came in and he said, oh, I see you're wearing some new boots today. I guess you think you're going to kick my butt with some psycho mumbo jumbo, huh? And I said, yep, I guess I am. And he said, is that what you do with the money from our sessions? And I said, and you know, I want you to know that I'm not like this with every, I mean, some clients I'm really, you know, actually more quiet and soft. You know, I just kind of adapt to what I think they'll be responsive to. So with him though, I knew I just had to spar back with him. And so, he said, is that what you do with the money from our sessions? Go out and buy boots like that? And I said, yep. And I guess you're indirectly asking me if this therapy thing has been worth your money, aren't you? And he goes, yep. That's exactly what I'm asking you. And I said, well, let's test it out. And I said, I think you're ready to go cross some bridges today, because he had a phobia of bridges. And we live right on the Tennessee River, so you can't get anywhere without crossing the river in our town. Yeah. So it's a problem if you have a bridge phobia.
Yes, I would say so.
So I said, we could go down here to the park and just try crossing the bridge that crosses over a creek. That's connected to the river, but you know, I'm trying to do some gradual exposure here. And I said, we could go down there today if you want to. We could try that, and you could test it out and see if it's been worth your money. And he goes, I don't need you to go down there with me and hold my little hand. And you know, and he was just being such a smart aleck. And I said, well, I know you don't. And I said, you can do it on your own, but I bet you won't. He goes, I bet I will. I said, I bet you won't. And I bet I will. I said, I bet you $50 you won't do it. And he goes, are you serious? I said, yeah. He goes, you give me $50 if I go do it. And I said, sure, but I don't have to worry because you're not going to do it. He goes, I'm going to go do it right now. And he stormed out of my office and went down to that park and crossed over that bridge, which may not seem like a big deal to some of you who've not had a bridge phobia, but and if you saw this creek, you would understand why it was. It was a good start for him. because the creek is wide. I mean, it's not a little bitty creek. And he took a picture of himself when he got to the other side of the bridge. He took a picture of himself with his phone, sticking his tongue out and texting me. And then he came back because this park is literally just a block from my office. And there was enough time in the session. He came back by. And I mean, he asked me on the text, do you want me to come back by or just schedule another appointment? I said, you know, you got a few minutes if you want to come back over. Congratulations, you know. And he came back in and he said, ha, 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 I want my $50. And I gave it to him. And, you know, I've never done that with a client before and I've not done it since. It's not that I wouldn't, but this guy scared me so bad that I really thought he was going to commit suicide if I didn't get something happening. Yeah. So I was willing to do it.
That story is really illustrates so wonderfully your adaptability and flexibility to kind of track the person and give them what they need. For example, one of the things we're running out of time here.
I had about
25 other questions. Don't be sorry. I'm glad because I would rather get the kind of depth that we're getting into the things that you've been talking about. But one of the things you talked about was align, lift, and lead as kind of a formula.
Yes.
Maybe just say a little bit about that in relation to this story that you just told us.
Okay. Thank you. Because this will help for the audience. This one formula has helped me more than anything else. And if you just do this one thing, it'll change the whole tone of your session. So, I call it the align, lift, and lead language formula. So you align with the client by doing your reflective listening, but you use the has been tense change, which is something I learned in hypnosis, so that you're lessening the intensity of the problem. So, for example, with Michael, you know, I have these panic attacks. I can't even cross a bridge. I hate myself and I want to die. And I'd say, wow. So, you've been struggling with this panic stuff for a long time, I hear. And it's gotten to the point where you've been wondering if you can pull out of it. And what I'm doing with that, instead of just being reflective, I'm saying to a subconscious, so you've been having this feeling. I didn't say, so you're depressed. I said, so there's been this panic that you've been struggling with. And basically I'm lifting by saying it's good you're here and you're interested in finding a way to pull out of it. It's good that you want to be here with me today as we look at some ways that you can move out of it, which is leading him towards where he wants to go. Now we're not just talking about the problem, but we start talking about, yeah, what would that be like? And it's different from the miracle question like you would hear in solution-focused therapy, because the therapist usually you have to give them some prompts and ideas, I find. If you say, well, what would it be? What would you be doing if you didn't have this panic? Sometimes they go, I don't know. I've lived with it. I have no idea. So you do better if you can kind of start to help them fill that in. So I might have said to Michael, I don't remember exactly now, but I might have said, so to feel like you could move forward, maybe reconnecting with your music, because he also played music, reconnecting where you can actually play music with some of your friends again. Yeah, that would be nice. So I didn't lead by going, you know, he also used to fly airplanes. So I didn't lead by saying, and you'll be able to fly airplanes again. That would have been too much for him. So when you lead, you just kind of to go one or two steps beyond where they're at now so that they begin to feel hopeful and like change is possible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we've kind of run out of time here. And it's good in a way that we didn't cover as much of your book, of the specifics, as I had kind of possibly planned, because now people will have to actually get your book and read it, which they should. It's clear that you're not only a born therapist, but also a born trainer, and you've really broken things down, and you've done John Connolly's work for him. You know, you told him you need to manualize this thing, and you've kind of done a lot of that for him, I think. So as we wind down, is there anything else you'd like to add?
The only other thing I'd like to add, one thing that I do talk about the book that I think is really important for therapists to know is I do believe in memory reconsolidation, and I do think that research is important. And Bruce Ecker, of course, has talked to you about it extensively.
Yeah.
And my book just gives you some additional ways. Bruce and I talk, and I'm really close with the coherence therapy people, and I do a lot of similar things, but I'm just giving some more ways that you can juxtapose an experience. Like, what you have to do is bring up how the client has been feeling, and then you have to juxtapose it with what they call a mismatch experience, something that would cause them to feel and think completely differently. And you can do that with music, like songs and playlists. You can do it with stories. You can do it with imagery or those playful games, or with movement. And that's basically what the rest of the book is about, is how I give you step-by-step instructions for how you can do those different things in a session to change.
Yeah, I was really impressed by that, that you had broken down the memory reconsolidation, which I also have been very impressed by, into a 5-step process, you know, in just a few pages. And so your book is just a wonderful contribution to the literature. And so Courtney Armstrong.
That means a lot to me coming from you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to everyone out there in Shrink Wrap Land who's listening.
Yeah, right. Okay. For all you therapists and would-be therapists, I can't recommend this book too highly. I know I've said this about other books as well, but hey, you're just going to have to suck it up and grow your library. If you ever had the feeling that your sessions are getting stale, wondering what you could possibly do to breathe more life into them, then this is an essential book for you. This is a relatively slim volume. The hardback version is just under 200 pages long, but is jam-packed with solid theory and very practical strategies for injecting excitement into your sessions and getting your clients unstuck. I really could have used a book like this when I was in training, and even since. You know, I've said this about several of the books I've featured here lately, and I have to say it's because there's been a real sea change out there since I was in school so long ago. As you heard us discuss at the beginning of the interview, it really does seem like there is more and more convergence around what makes for effective, successful therapy. And it's not about this or that school of thought as much as it is about a growing understanding of how the brain works and the implications for therapy that flow out of that. Consequently, there are a whole crop of books lately that deal with the specifics of good therapy in a way that previously just wasn't available. After I turned off the recorder, I shared with Courtney that I wish her book had been out when I was a student. She shared that, in fact, it was her aim to write the book that she would have liked to have had when she was a student. I think she has succeeded in that goal admirably. I'm amazed by her ability to digest and synthesize all the information she has and then get to the practical implications and techniques succinctly and without dumbing it down. As always, you can order the Therapeutic Aha 10 Strategies for Getting Your Clients Unstuck by Courtney Armstrong using our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, I'm Heather. I'm a graduate student, and I was really excited to stumble upon Shrink Wrap Radio and an article with an author whose articles I've been reading recently. It was very cool to hear. I chose to send a contribution to Shrink Wrap Radio because I really want to support this kind of grassroots educational initiative that's being done. I made a small contribution, and I figure, you know, for every I gained something from it by listening to it, and I would like to support that being out there for other people to hear, and I just, it's a really cool thing that you guys are doing, and so thank you.
Thank you, Heather, for that very supportive testimonial and challenge. If you're not currently helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio, I hope you'll take the opportunity right now to rise to Heather's challenge and become a regular financial supporter of this heartfelt endeavor. Thousands of you are regular listeners who've not yet risen to this challenge. Fortunately, I can announce 5 new donors, and 2 of whom are returning ones since the last podcast episode. Susan McFarland is a new donor. Louise Callanan, Saren Loftus are both returning donors. And Nicholas Haig Nielsen and Lorraine Spencer are new donors. So thank you, all 5 of you, for standing up and helping to support my hard work here on your behalf. And I want to thank all of you who have purchased our new standalone app for Shrink Wrap Radio. I've heard reports from local friends who have bought it, and they love it. They agree it's a much better solution than the podcast box solution we offered previously. We have a version for the iPhone and other iOS devices, plus for both Android and Windows smartphones. Just go to the Apps tab at shrinkwrapradio.com and get yours today. The Jung Platform is one of our strategic partners, and they have a new course coming up that I think many of my listeners will be interested in. It's a 10-class webinar, and the title of it is The Frankenstein Prophecies, Jungian Archetypal Reflections on Ecological Crisis and the God Wars. And that's by Jungian analyst Robert Romanishin, PhD. Now, the course description reads, based on a close reading of Mary Shelley's novel, this webinar series explores multiple ways her story is a retelling of the mythic tale of Prometheus and the Christian story of creation within the context of science and technology. And it goes on. I won't read the whole thing. You can read it on my site. About the speaker, Robert Romanishin, he's an affiliate member of the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts and an emeritus professor of psychology in the clinical and depth psychotherapy programs at Pacifica Graduate Institute. He's authored 6 books, has contributed chapters to numerous edited volumes, and published essays and reviews in many professional journals. In addition, he conducts lectures and workshops in the U.S. He's taught and lectured in Europe, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and parts of Africa. Now, the sessions begin on August 12th, and there are 10 sessions. And you don't have to be present. If you sign up, you'll be able to get these on audio and video. And so the first session is a presentation of 7 prophetic themes in Mary Shelley's original story. The second section is introduction, technology as a cultural symptom and collective dream. The third session, stealing fire from the gods, titanic hubris. The fourth one, conceived by man but not born of woman. The 5th, flight from death. The 6th, the Eichmann complex. The 7th is the last generation, The 8th is the orphan, the 9th is fire and ice, and number 10, what are poets for in a destitute time? Well, I think this sounds very appealing for all of you Jungians. And you can get full details by going to the Partners tab on shrinkwrapradio.com, and there you'll find a link. And if you go through my link, you'll get a 10% discount from the price of the whole series. So I hope at least some of you will do this. It sounds fascinating and educational. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite book service, let me recommend an audiobook by Bill O'Hanlon, who you heard me mention earlier and who today's guest, Courtney Armstrong, cites frequently in her book and credits as one of her main mentors. The title is The Change Your Life Book by Bill O'Hanlon. It's a relatively short but highly inspirational book. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that one's not to your taste, they have over 180,000 other titles for you to choose from. By the way, stay tuned for some special music at the end of today's episode. I think you'll like it.
Hi, this is Andy Matzner, psychotherapist, author, and tarot reader, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Andrew Matzner. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and I'll read just one from our listener community, and it's from Sue Ellen in Australia, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've been meaning for so long to do this donation, as I'm sure many others have also. I'm a bit shy about speaking on a recording. I may get some Dutch courage up at some point, and I will email a file to you then if this should happen. I've known about your podcasts for some time after James Alexander told me about them. From memory, I downloaded the app and had a look after he discussed them at one of our EMDR supervision meetings, and then I also got them on iTunes. I spent 4 hours driving up to work in Toowoomba, Queensland, from the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales, and the 4 hours driving back Sundays and Wednesdays each week, so I get a lot of time to listen to your podcasts and also to audiobooks. Most of the time, when I'm listening, I'm in the car, but the other day I was at home and listening on the computer to your interview with Greg Lavoie, and at the end, when your listener was encouraging me to donate, I just went and hit the button, and there you are. It's about time. I have been a closet listener for some time now, feeling guilty instead of taking action. I spread news of your podcasts and their content far and wide, and I'm so grateful for the work that you put into them. I love your choice of guests and how you approach the interview in a very personal manner and ask such good questions. I feel like I'm having the conversation sometimes. I look forward to many more of your conversations. Thanks again." And that's from Sue Ellen Taylor, psychologist, Lismore, New South Wales. And Sue Ellen, I'm so glad that you finally clicked on that donate button. And I really appreciate getting this background information about you. I'll try to keep the good stuff coming your way. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Courtney Armstrong, for her helpful insights on getting therapy clients unstuck. My next interview will be with return guest Jungian analyst Nancy Ferlotti, and she'll be discussing the correspondence between C.G. Jung and the very influential psychologist Eric Neumann. We'll learn a lot from this interview, at least I know I will. Be sure to stay tuned now for some special music composed and performed by last week's guest, Robert Hedaya, M.D., founder of Whole Psychiatry. I think you'll be surprised and delighted. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
We're moving to life, we're moving to love, we're moving to hate. We're moving to war, we're moving to each other, we wonder what for. It's all in the name of the game, it's all in the way of the game. We do it to keep it the same, running around we're insane. You love me again, you touch me and then you fade into darkness, you leave me with light. You live into faith and you hope into love. It's all in the name of your grace, it's all in the smile on your face. You hide the pain for the gain, running around in your maze. jump into life. I fall on my face. I hold myself down. I cannot embrace. I struggle some more than I look for the door. It's just the way that I am. It makes me less of a man. I do it 'cause it's all I've known. I do it 'cause it's just like home. We try to wake up, our dreams are so real. We like to be numb, but we like to feel. Our eyes open slowly, the shadows make a light. It's hard to wake to the pain. It hurts to know we're insane. We do it again and again. Makes love an eternal flame. We walk to the water, the river of life. We swim in the ocean, it's a Jungian ocean. We say we are moving, but who are we fooling? We're happy to dance in the rain. We have joy and hope and pain. I wonder the point of the game. A crucible of love needs a flame. Now as it begins, so it shall end. Born into life, we struggled for breath. Touched by love, scarred by pain. Yet the birds wake up with the dawn. The deer caresses the fawn. The heart is what keeps us warm. It's just the way we were born. La la la. Refrain. Why don't I sing it again? It's all in the name of the game. It's all in the name of the game. I like being insane.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.